Welcome back, students, to the Western Theological Tradition. This week, we're going to be looking at the topic of origins. We're going to spend 3 days considering several different views on how the universe, and especially mankind and the animals, came about. Many of you are familiar that evolution is the reigning theory on the origins of life and species and even mankind. And so we're going to look at this together. Before we start our journey through the Bible, now I have a couple reasons why we're going to do this. Number one is a lot of individuals find the Bible questionable because of their evolutionary thoughts. And so obviously evolution is the reigning theory on the origin of man. And so the Bible does not seem to present itself as that. And so as they approach the Bible, they tend to doubt that this would have anything to say about our current condition, whether historically or with regard to the world. And so I want to introduce to you this week ways that people have looked at this. Not everybody who believes in evolution rejects Christianity or rejects the Bible. And so there's been different ways that people have considered these things. I want to look at them this week. And possibly, it would be my desire that this would kind of soften the way or prepare the way to give the Bible a fresh read and to be able to consider it on its own merits. And so that's my desire and the reason why I put this week in the course. Now, it's also here as a good illustration of the significance of the fact-value split with regard to theology in the West. You've been reading Escape from Reason by Francis Schaeffer. I want to just go over a couple things that he says in chapters 4 to 6 that are very pertinent to this specific topic. Schaeffer talks, as you remember, that Aquinas is the beginning of the modern distinction between theology and philosophy. Before that time, basically, revelation, what God said, and then science or investigation, what man could find or think, was kind of in a big puddle. It's all on the ground, and you could build reasoning based on all of it. The distinction, apparently, was not clearly demarcated. And what Schaeffer says, and we had a handout from Joseph Ratzinger, the former pope, saying essentially the same thing, is that Aquinas is the beginning of that distinction between theology and philosophy. So let me just go back over that again. Both of them present to you a ladder, but they set the ladder on different ground. Theology sets the ladder on revelation, in this case, a Bible, and says, on the basis of the Bible, start reasoning, start thinking. And so Augustine famously described it as faith seeking understanding. So you take into account what God has said when you go out and look at the world and think about the world. Don't ignore what God said, incorporate it. In fact, build upon it so that your interpretation of the world is seen through the lens of what God has said. Now, philosophy says that's cheating. In a sense, it acts like you should think on your own and find out, as C.S. Lewis said famously in the beginning of Mere Christianity, what you can learn on your own steam. And so, starting out with your own experiences and your own observation, kind of like Ecclesiastes, as we saw last week, has as its basis, go out into the world and see what you can find, think what you think, and how far up can you go? That is philosophy. So these two ladders in Thomas Aquinas were distinct, but they weren't separate. There's not a fact-value split. And so the ladders are right next to each other, and as we discussed last week, that the philosopher will climb up the ladder so far, and then at a certain point, he has to switch over to the ladder of faith to know about the incarnation, to know about the Trinity, mysteries that are purely revealed and would not be known by looking at the stars. The simple-minded people have the ladder of faith, and they can start from the very bottom and just take what God gives them. And that's because they're not philosophically trained or able to climb those difficult rungs of logic. Now, those two ladders, then, reigned until the early modern period, until, well, 1800s, let's say. But they started getting separated. And in the Enlightenment, the ladder of philosophy rejected the ladder of revelation and then asserted its own autonomy, a law unto itself, that on the basis of what we can empirically discover, we will ascertain laws of the universe that surrounds us and uncover its mysteries and see the big picture. And so the ladder then begun to be climbed. And in the 1800, around that time period, with the criticisms of David Hume and the response of Immanuel Kant, basically it fell into what Schaeffer calls the line of despair. The ladder did not climb up very high. We could not see outside the little box that we live in to know what's outside the box. We never got to see the big picture. And so the West despaired of discovering the grand reality, the answers to the ultimate questions, the big picture. And as a result of that, instead of going back to the ladder of faith, grounded on revelation, it questioned the whole idea of a ladder at all. Maybe rationality should be chucked. So Schaeffer distinguishes between rationalism and rationality. Rationality is just you have the ability to think. Rationalism says the ladder of thinking is planted firmly on what humans can think on their own. Now, to be very technical, rationalism is like geometry. It's purely in your mind. You start out with self-evident truths and you argue from there step by step, rung by rung. This is true, therefore this is true, climbing higher and higher. Descartes, who is a mathematician, I think analytic geometry owes its origin largely to him. He's a big contributor. And he started famously by doubting everything and then realizing, I think, therefore I am. And on the basis of that axiom or self-evident truth, he then builds a system, and he was religious, a system that proves God and all things essentially starts moving up. I don't know about all things, but starts moving in that direction. That's a rationalistic system. Empiricism would do the same kind of thing, but on the basis of discovering facts, going out and looking at the world, doing experiments and such, rather than just pure thought. Both rationalism and empiricism share, though, the idea that the human thinking, call it reason, that ladder can be planted firmly on the ground and we can go somewhere with it. That's why it's an ism. Both of them are isms. There's confidence in that system of thought to get us somewhere. Well, once that was a failure, shown to be a failure, it wasn't man, as I said, Western man didn't go back to the other ladder. Instead, it questioned all ladders, all rationality itself, even the fundamental fact of reality or the fundamental basis for thinking. The law of non-contradiction might be false. The idea that A and not A can both exist in the same way at the same time. Now that's a contradiction. A and not A, this exists, and this same very thing at this very same time does not exist, is a true contradiction. Well, once that was questioned, and Hegel famously questioned it, thesis and antithesis, A and not A, can combine and become synthesis. Once that was then asserted, and he had being and non-being can become becoming, once that whole idea of a contradiction was accepted and rationality was chucked, then it opened the door to defining meaning subjectively, personally or as our own little tribe, and it doesn't have to be verified, and it cannot be falsified by definition. We define ourselves the meaning that we have, and that, with the Romantic era, has led to postmodernism, which is one of the reigning worldviews, as we saw in our time. Schaefer calls that a fact-value split, where you have the scientific naturalism looking at facts, and then up above it, totally separate from it, is the realm of value, of meanings. That form of thinking, dichotomous form of thinking, he says, is the shape of all modern thought. And to go from the bottom to the top requires a leap. I think Kierkegaard, the Danish call him Kierkegaard or something like that, Kierkegaard called it a leap of faith, I believe. And so that is not the same thing as what Christianity said, take what God has said and believe it, or even in the sciences that you have to have a certain trust in your instruments and your thought process. There has to be a certain faith even there. It's not the idea that just faith has to be involved. This is a leap of faith. That my personal meaning does not have to be grounded in anything verifiable. And so it is not a unified field of knowledge. It is a split. And so that leap of faith then is seen as a courageous thing, a daring thing. I think with Kierkegaard, from what I've heard, it's even you can believe the irrational. Or I think there's an essay by Chesterton that talks about nonsense being a good kind of pointer towards faith. As if something being irrational makes it believable now, like in the realm of faith. Totally pitting against reason rather than something like a reasonable faith. Finding something in the world, an unknown God, and then saying, I'm going to go seek after that God. Well, that fact-value split finds itself manifested specifically in two realms. In the area of history and the area of the cosmos. We're going to look at the area of history when we cover historicism later. The area of the cosmos, in other words, the world that we live in and how it came about and the science that's behind it and the implications that philosophers draw from it, that has often been seen as contrary to the Bible, but many religious individuals have said it doesn't matter what science or the philosophers say from science, the world is all about. All that matters is you can believe. And that it's like a jump with no ladder up to the clouds. And it is safe. Faith is safe in the clouds. It's interesting. Schaefer talks about T.H. Huxley on page 106, or no, excuse me, 96. That near the end of his life, and he was called Darwin's bulldog, I think. He promoted evolutionary thought in England. And Huxley said that there will be a time such that no longer in contact with fact of any kind, faith stands now and forever proudly inaccessible to the attacks of the infidel. Those who were liberal in their theology at the time thought that this was the perfect solution to the problem of science and religion, is that religion does not have to be based on any fact. It can be utterly disconnected, and once it's in the clouds, up in the stratosphere, it is safe from all falsification. It doesn't need to be verified, therefore it cannot be falsified. And so Huxley, in 1890, says this is how faith is being treated, and Schaefer then commented, because modern theology has accepted the dichotomy and removed the things of religion from the world of the verifiable, modern theology is now in the position that Huxley prophesied. So we're going to look at it. And so let's consider then the significance of evolution, the definition of evolution, the two kinds historically of evolution, which is something we often don't hear. And then we'll specifically look at Darwin's book, what it was about and offer some assessment that will lead us into this week. So let's begin then with the significance. First, evolution is a big part of the debate between theists and atheists. The question of whether there's a God pertains directly to the world and how the world came about. Because if God is anything, he is involved with creation. He is the creator. Now, on the side of atheism, Richard Dawkins, I am told, I've seen this quote several times, once said that evolution made him an intellectually satisfied atheist. Now, he's an Oxford zoologist and has often written books popularly against the idea of God and has used and incorporated lots of claims from evolution. On the other side of it, a former atheist, Anthony Flew, who even gets mentioned in Escape from Reason, ditched his atheism on the basis of claims made from intelligent design, that the world evidences design and points to a designer, and he was convinced, apparently, in the early 2000s, of the legitimacy of those claims, and so moved from an atheistic position to a theist position. And so there you see that right in the middle of the debate, whether movement is from theism to atheism or vice versa, the question of origins is pertinent. And you'll see it a lot in debates of this kind. Number two, evolution was also significant to how the West began to view religion in general. I have in my cabinet a place where I put books that I don't want people to just happenstance, you know, come upon and then start to read. It's kind of my poison cabinet. And one big fat book I think I got from somebody emptying out an attic once is on, it's from, I think, the Chicago World's Fair of Religions or something. An exposition of religions from, like, say, 1890s. Article after article brings forth the position that religion began in the primitive peoples as they didn't understand the forces mysteriously, you know, directing and shaping their lives. And so they attributed to the rocks and the trees spirits. This animism, it's called, then controlled their lives with a deep fear. Over time, the gods began to take shape and have personality and so get names. And the myths started developing and those gods, the pantheon of gods, started appearing in cultures. And you know many of those from Nordic myths and Greek myths and such. Later, one god emerged as top, and then the others started to fade away. And monotheism developed, first in Israel, among the Jews, and then in other peoples. And now that we're in modern times, we realize that science has explained to us what we see around us, and we don't need a god in the gaps to kind of, you know, explain things that we don't understand yet. And so this is the way the view is normally taken and the direction it's normally pointed to, that religiously we have moved beyond even having the need of a god, and even if we recognize a religious sense within us, it's like John Dewey's book, The Common Faith. It can be applied to things like the democratic ideal. And so we can have that religious devotion to an idea. We don't have to have it to a person in the sky. It's interesting. I've been told, and I would like to study this and read on this and see if this is true, that it actually works in reverse. That really, the history of civilizations and people moves from a monotheism downward towards the other things that were presented up first. And so I think that's probably an anthropological study, but it would certainly have a historical element to it. And so I'm going to leave that for now. It would be interesting to visit it someday. The last area that shows how significant evolution is to the Western theological tradition is the social Darwinism movement's in the late 1800s and early 1900s. The idea of evolution was applied to society. Societies evolve, and cultures evolve, and civilizations evolve. And so the disciplines, sociology and such, the new disciplines that were being developed at the time, started incorporating evolutionary thinking as kind of a model for approaching the big things in their discipline. I think a good example of this is a speech given by Woodrow Wilson in 1912 as he was candidating for the presidency. He mentioned how the framers of this country lived in a Newtonian world, and they looked at the Constitution and the society that they were going to govern in terms of laws that were fixed, almost like a machine has to operate a certain way. But now we understand that societies change and are like a living organism. And so the implication is the Constitution doesn't apply today, having written in that kind of a way. And so this progressive president, who eventually, you know, promoted the expert administrative state that wasn't at all tied to the Constitution, was basically implying, as did judges at the time, that the Constitution is a living document, and it applies then to a living society that changes. Well, that social Darwinism and history of religion both show that this is far more than just a personal matter of grounding my own faith in a God. It has affected the West. Evolution is a thought that has moved into all sorts of disciplines, and so to bring it into our theology class would not be out of bounds. It applies very much. Well, let's define what we mean by evolution. Probably the most simplest definition is speciation, that one species can develop into another species. And Darwin, in his book, The Origin of Species, spent a lot of time actually seeking, how do you define a species? For him, it was advantageous to question the firm boundaries that people were given to species in his day. But basically, we can kind of think of them as a kind. I mean, whether dogs and coyotes and wolves are originally part of the same kind or species or not, eventually, what Darwin and evolutionary thinking is saying is not that level of change, even though that itself may be great. But the change that goes from small organisms of life to then larger, more complex ones, and branches out to all sorts of the reptiles and birds, and finally the mammals and man. In the 1800s, it was seen as a progressive tree of life. In modern times, I've told, it's more of a bush. It doesn't have to conform to our ideas of progress and movement or a higher order of being. All it is saying is that species adapt to changes in their environment in such a way that enables them to survive. Those that have minor variations that enable them to survive, those variations then are perpetuated in the offspring. And according to Darwin, if given enough time, they can then lead to actually new species developing new forms. And we see eventually all the creatures that we see, the animals that we see today. Now, I actually imported a little Darwinian thought in there. In reality, speciation is basically it. Adaptation and speciation, new species out of old species, or what he would call descent with modification. That all the species are in a family tree, they have ancestors, and the offspring of those ancestors are true descendants, and so species come from species, there is a descent, and as they descend, there's modification of their structures that enable them to survive. Now, the two kinds of evolution were introduced to me in Peter Bowler's book. It's called Evolution, the History of an Idea. And a few years back, I had the privilege of reading this book. It's very detailed and very well written. And I was amazed to find out that in the 1800s, Darwinian evolution was actually not the form of evolution that was popular. I believe even T.H. Huxley himself didn't believe in natural selection, which is Darwin's key idea. Lamarckian evolution, though, was very popular in the late 1800s in Great Britain. And Lamarckian evolution, Lamarck was a Frenchman, I believe, asserted that external or acquired traits can be passed on to offspring or are hereditary. Now that works really good with breeding. And so good breeding, right? You know, you've developed your mind and you've been cultured and educated, or your physique and you've worked hard, and you then have acquired intellectual strength or acquired physical strength, and you can pass it along to your offspring as a result. That good breeding coming from those kind of parents. Now, that idea was killed with the Mendelian Revolution around 1900. Gregor Mendel, who at a monastery in the what would be now, I believe, the Czech Republic, studied his peas and the growing of peas and the principles that was developed there. And by the way, one essay I wrote or read recently said he was more of a scientist that was poor and joined this monastic community that loved to study than he was, say, just a true monk that happened to do some gardening. Not a true monk, he's a true monk, but a monk that happened to do some gardening and then stumbled upon these things. He was a scientific student to begin with. And so his idea of the unit gene, that traits are tied back digitally within creatures, that it's an on-off switch, as it were, that says the plant's going to be tall, or the plant's going to be short, it's going to have blue eyes, or it's going to have brown eyes. That kind of tracing back to things deep within the cell, and we now know it to be the DNA, basically killed Lamarckian thought. Because Lamarck was saying that the external things can get passed on, and then the Mendelian Revolution said it's all, as it were, encoded internally, and the chromosomes coming together at conception determine the shape and the nature of the offspring. Well, once that was incorporated in the 20th century with the idea of natural selection, the idea that slight variations which accumulate over time that allow a population to succeed, to survive, that those, what Herbert Spencer called the survival of the fittest, once that idea was combined with the genetics that was discovered and verified in the early 20th century, it formed a neo-Darwinian synthesis that basically then says natural selection happens through genetic mutations. So, that's the reigning idea or scientific orthodoxy today. You should probably know that biology formed at that time in the early 20th century. It was a combination of zoology and botany on the idea, if I remember this from Peter Bowler, on the idea of evolution. That when somebody claims that if you don't think evolutionarily, you can't do biology. It's interesting, there's some historical backing to that claim because the very science of biology was apparently grounded in this idea of evolutionary development, of connecting all the species together into this bush of life. Now, I personally have some objections to that, but we're going to explore this topic this week, and I hope this has given you now the basis historically of looking at it. By the way, one thing I failed to mention as we went through the topic of social Darwinism, Peter Bowler mentions that progress was the reigning assumption in the 1800s. And if you think back to that era of scientific discovery and technological advancement, in which Europe experienced an unusual season of peace, other than the Franco-Prussian War of 1871, there was a long stretch of peace. And so the idea was held out that civilization is advancing and progressing in all sorts of ways, and that this assumption of progress then made it very palatable to believe in evolution among animals. A kind of progress, even though that's denied now, but that progress to higher and higher forms of life. That was kind of my hunch as I looked at why was that idea so quickly believed in the 1800s. And it was quite satisfying to see that is actually the case, as the historian Peter Bowler says. Now let's talk about Charles Darwin for a second. Charles Darwin is an Englishman, and he was a man that made his name basically through a 5-year voyage on the HMS Beagle. He was the accompaniment to the captain of the ship, I think that by the name of Fitzroy. And the previous captain had committed suicide, I think off the coast of Argentina. And so, from my understanding, this companion to the captain was to give intellectual stimulus, a kind of aristocratic companion, not just, say, the sailors and the kind of the scrubs doing the job on the deck. And so Darwin became Fitzroy's companion for a 5-year exploratory voyage, mainly around South America. And so they would dock, he would explore on land, he'd look at the geology. He was very interested in geology at the time, collect specimens, send them back, or send news back to England about them from time to time. And when the voyage was all done in 1836, he published it, put all the things he had learned together and published it. That voyage was the stimulus to an idea that Darwin started writing down the late 1830s in notes. Ideas that spoke of how species changed. Eventually, he began to sketch it out, and as you know, in 1859, famously published one of the main books of modern thought, The Origin of Species. This last summer, I had the privilege, finally, of reading it. It had been my desire for a long time, and it's good 600 pages now, large print, thankfully, and page and line and a half spacing. But it took me several days, a good couple weeks, and I was amazed. It was not what I expected. It reads like a math problem. By that I mean like a philosophical work. Darwin himself called it in the final chapter one long argument. I think every single word of that makes sense. It is one book, and it's a unified theme. He did a very good job of incorporating all this data and making his point clear. It is very long. That is definitely true. And it is an argument. It's a philosophical treatise, which uses a lot of data to make a point. But the way it reads is one statement. If this is true, then we infer this statement. And if that's true, then this true, then that's true, then this is true, then that's true. And it is to read it is to hold in your head a whole line of argument, of logical reasoning. And so it's challenging. Because at any one point, if that's not true, well, then the chain breaks. And so you question and you wonder, well, is that true? Is that true? Is that true? In one sense, it's like the old name of science, natural philosophy. It really is a philosophical argument on the basis of the data that he was collecting. And as an argument, then, we need to ask a couple questions. What is he arguing for? And against what? So, What then is Darwin's chief argument? Like, what's his purpose? What is he arguing for? There's a quote that was very helpful to me from a letter that Darwin wrote to a younger associate and supporter of his work, Joseph Hooker. Hooker might be a generation younger than Darwin and was an enthusiastic supporter once he became convinced of the Darwinian and even, the Darwinian evolutionary theory of natural selection. In January 11th, 1844, Darwin wrote to Hooker a quote, a letter, and in it is this quote. He says, "I determined to collect blindly every sort of fact which could bear in any way on what our species." I mentioned earlier, it was very important to Darwin to define what a species is. It was his argument that many variations would be called species in certain cases mistakenly, and that many species have been mistakenly called species because in actuality they're variations. He wanted a flexibility with the boundaries of what a species is, because obviously in evolution the species break those boundaries and become new species. So if the variations point towards a breaking of the boundaries, that's important to his overall argument. To substantiate it and to even discover what a species is, he says in that letter that he blindly collected facts. I'm here to tell you, from what I read in that book and from what I've read about Darwin, he did just that. He was a collector. Now, I don't know how many of you in your childhood loved to collect things. I think I had rocks, bottle caps, maps, all sorts of just random facts. It was kind of fun. And I think Darwin was that way. And as a man, he would be called, and he called himself, a naturalist. He loved to go to the seashore, and he did with professors when he was a college student and collect things, go out and find things. Obviously, on the HMS Beagle, he's collecting all sorts of things. When he gets back to England in the 1850s, he has 10,000 specimens of barnacles, many of them sent by correspondents around the world. His abilities to categorize and classify that entire collection of barnacles and then publish shows that he is an accomplished naturalist. He is not just a sideshow scientist. The man has true abilities and a passion for gathering data about nature. His final book was on worms, even. And so, when we look at Charles Darwin, we are looking at a man who truly does love nature. In fact, it's often said, you know, that he wanted to become a parson, a country, you know, a clergyman, a local pastor. And I'm told that the reason why is that it would have given him a secured income and put him out in the countryside. So he found that favorable because he could go out then and collect things. And in that day, there was a lot of scientific reverends who were contributing to the scientific knowledge of the day through their studies. So that's what he's arguing on the basis of. He's collecting facts. Now, what was his thesis? He goes on to Hooker in the letter and says, "At last, gleams of light have come, and I am almost convinced, quite contrary to the opinion I started with, that species are not immutable." That statement is the thesis of the book, other than natural selection, that species change, and they change to the extent there's no limit, basically, to their change in Darwin's imagination and in his assertions, and that natural selection, which is the power to capitalize upon variations, slight variations that give an edge to a population surviving. Those then edge out the ones without the variation and propagate, and eventually then you see a migration of species into new species. Now, I left out a very significant line. A line in that, it's in parentheses. A line in that quote that tells us what Darwin is arguing against. The line is, "It is like confessing a murder." Let me read the whole sentence again. "At last gleams of light have come, and I am almost convinced," parentheses, "quite contrary to the opinion I started with," close parentheses, "that species are not," parentheses, "it is like confessing a murder," close parentheses, "immutable." Darwin was a sensitive man. He was a man that was very concerned about his reputation, and I do believe was also a sincere man in promoting civilization. It's not that he agreed with the missionaries and what they were doing on the religious level, but wherever they were promoting civilization through the world, he would support it. But he was a man that was very concerned about his reputation. He had seen in his college days a man ridden out of Cambridge because of the views that he had held, I think that were evolutionary views. This would be the 1820s. He knew that if this book, which was one long argument against a certain view of the Creator, if this book grabbed hold, it would kill off people's faith in that Creator. In a sense, it's like confessing a deicide. He is confessing killing off God. Now, here's the point I want to make on this. The view of God that he has is not the view of the Bible's God. It's a view coming from natural theology. William Paley and the others that were promoting it at the time, the view that his wife held, and she was Unitarian, denying the Trinity, is of a God who does everything perfectly. Kind of like Job's three friends who assume he's a God of justice, and if you are righteous, then you will prosper. It's simple, Job. Just confess your sins. It's a simplistic view of God, that God will always do things perfectly. And this idea of perfectly is how we define perfectly. But like Job, we step out into the world and we find many things that are not perfect. It's messy. It's confusing at times, and it doesn't make sense. The view that the Bible has on God is that God, yes, created the world perfectly, declared it, as Genesis 1 says, very good, but then, once man sinned, he bent the world. As Ecclesiastes says, what God has bent, who is able to straighten? So we live in a cursed world. A world where death and carnage and waste are all over the place. So to infer from that, that there's no God, would be only valid if the God of natural theology is the true God. Throughout the book, Darwin, I'm talking The Origin of Species, throughout the book, almost every chapter ends with some kind of statement of, on the old doctrine of the old theory of creation, these facts are inexplicable, but my theory can explain them. So the target of the book is that old theory of natural theology, the God who does everything perfectly. And so because Darwin is holding that God up as the target, kind of the foil against which he's presenting his own theory, I think Jonathan Wells rightly calls it a straw God argument. Just like a straw man argument would be presenting your opponent in a particular way and then knocking him over, Darwin presents this view of the Creator as if it's the only view and then knocks it over because it is unable to explain the things that he points at throughout his book. Now that's the article that you're going to read for Wednesday or for your next class period. The article by Jonathan Wells. And he does a very good job of taking many quotes from The Origin of Species. And it's one of the reasons why I wanted to read The Origin of Species, to see, is that really so? And I do think it is. So let me just offer this assessment as I close. This is how we're going to approach the issue on the next couple class times. Number one, this is a cosmogony. Evolution is part of a cosmogony. That word literally means the origin or the genesis of the cosmos, the world. Evolution, where the species come about, is part of how the whole world came about, which now includes theories of the Big Bang and otherwise, the origin of life and such. That subject is in its nature a historical question. So we're going to treat it as a history question. These are unique, big events that cannot be repeated, or if they are repeated, are going to be very rare again. Of course, the origin of the world, of the universe, is not a repeated thing per se, unless there's some kind of cyclical nature to the universe. So we're going to treat it as a historical question rather than a question of something that is repeated over and over again in nature. It incorporates those things like adaptation within a species, but it's bigger. Number two, that will require this to be an interdisciplinary study. It can't just be relegated to the biology department. As we saw earlier, historically it spilled over into all sorts of things. But to ascertain something historically requires a certain kind of logic, and it requires an openness to all kinds of data. The same way that detectives use forensic science, keeping themselves open to a variety of things, even an intelligence being part of the causation to what is seen at the crime scene. Third, our goal will be an explanatory power, a view that has explanatory power that can explain much, if not all, of the facts and the evidences that are present. Now, in doing so, I'm admitting to you that we are going to take this then in a certain direction. And this is going to be a direction that will be compatible to intelligent design, which I'll present in two class periods. Even though that itself is not per se the view that I hold personally, I think the nature of the case, though, is historical. And so I'm going to treat it in that way in this class. So, because it's historical in nature, and we kind of have the business of a detective or a judge trying to ascertain what happened here, there are evidences that act like eyewitnesses. And if we were in class and had the time, I would stand at the board and ask you, so what are the kind of things that show up in the evolution debate to substantiate that this actually occurs? And students have often given to me answers such as genetics or DNA, adaptation in animals that we find in the wild, cases, case studies, vestigial organs, organs that appear to have no purpose now, and supposedly then, or at least would perhaps then be things that evolution once had a purpose for and now kind of they're going away. The fossil record, that's a big one. Coupled with that is the geological column. This would be the prime witness to the creatures in the past, the animals that have lived in the past. Homology, that's a fancy word for this structure on this animal and this structure on that animal, actually do come from a common ancestor. They don't just look similarly or develop similarly due to similar environments. The old language for that was that's an analogy. A homology is those structures come from an ancestor. Geographic distribution, how plants, similar plants ended up on continents far apart, or animals, similar animals ended up there. How did they get there? The old view that Darwin's arguing against was that the creator knew exactly the creature that should be in exactly that spot, and so he fashioned very fine-tuned species and put them all over the world. As if every little variety of species was created de novo, out of nothing, by the creator. And on top of all that is also then artificial breeding, artificial selection, which is domestic breeding. And Darwin himself had a collection of pigeons and was amazed to see that these fantails and these tumblers all came from this rock dove, you know, kind of your basic pigeon. And they don't even look much similar to that. And so it was a fascinating thing for him to imagine extrapolating out from there what other weird and unexpected forms would come about from these basic current creatures. So it's these topics then that you're going to read about in Jonathan Wells's article. And I think you're going to see as he walks through it that Darwin's straw guard argument actually still plays a role today. And so I think you'll find it fascinating. We'll come back next time and examine this issue from the perspective of those who are theists, who believe in God and believe in evolution. That will be our topic next time. Thank you.